We'll take the bills. We'll take House Bill number 106 first. This has been in subcommittee. It's an act related to the payment of criminal fines and restitution. I've placed this in subcommittee with Representative Frank. Representative Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your folders, the members have a brief memo which summarizes the changes we're proposing in the form of a Finance Committee substitute, and if you'd like, I could briefly outline those if you think necessary. I guess we made the clarifications we discussed when Representative Davison testified before the committee. On line 12 of page 1, we wanted to make it clear that the court could order restitution to a victim and or to an organization that had provided services to the victim. One change that we did make there is on line 12 to insert the word and that would enable a public institution such as a hospital to get restitution as well as a private. I'm sorry, we inserted the word private. Public was already there. We inserted the word private hospital could qualify. The other substantive change is on page 1, line 29, where we eliminated some words, and the result is that the court could order restitution regardless of the victim's need. So any victim, it was the intent of the author of the legislation, that any victim considered for restitution by the court. So the subcommittee recommends that we pass the proposed Finance Committee substitute. Thank you.
Representative Frank, any comments before?
No, I think the chairman did a good job.
Okay. At this time, the chair will entertain a motion to adopt the committee substitute so we have something before us. Is there any objection? None?
No, I was just going to make the motion.
Representative Larson, questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would this enforced restitution also allow for the assignment of a permanent fund dividend check? In other words, I know many hospitals do use that method at this time, that a person can assign their permanent fund dividend check to the hospital in relation to payment for services that they receive. And I assume that this would allow that to be done, would not prohibit it.
Doesn't seem to me that it would prohibit it. I hadn't really thought about that in relation to that. I would assume whatever, you know, we had the other legislation before us addressing the assignment of the permanent fund, so I assume however the law, whatever arrangements the law allows, would be here that would affect that I can see.
My concern was that a person might be assigned to make restitution. He or she may refuse to do so, and that if this would allow that facility then to take an assignment on the permanent fund dividend check. And this question, thank you.
Yes. Representative Frank?
I guess I was just going to talk about that a little bit, too. I think they'd be able to get a judgment. The court could, in fact, in the first place, I think, order the restitution be in that form, I think. I'm not positive on that. But if they, on the second page, under Section 3, outlines, you know, what the... If they have to show that they have made a good faith effort in order to escape prison. So there's some teeth in it there.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Say, I'm informed by my staff that this would work just like any other judgment in a court, which I'm informed that the court could order up to 50% of the permanent fund check to be.
Further questions? Does anybody from the public like to testify on committee substitute for House Bill number 106, Finance? Is there any further questions of the committee?
What's the pleasure of the
committee? Representative Frank.
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we move out committee substitute for House Bill 106 with individual recommendation.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We'll take up this House Bill number 122. We have before us committee substitute for House Bill number 122, Judiciary, by the Judiciary Committee. The sponsor is at the request of the governor. This bill is similar to a bill that passes committee in the House. It prohibits a plaintiff and a defendant from agreeing to a civil compromise in order to get a judge to dismiss a case against a defendant charged with domestic violence. A civil compromise is almost always a financial out of court settlement. The judiciary CS also removes the prohibition against civil compromise for larceny. The bill has no fiscal impact at this time. Here to testify on is Gail Heretzi with Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if I could refer to the Council on Domestic Violence and the network representative.
Very good. Barbara? Or who wants to come? Good, please.
For the record, my name is Margot Dick, and I'm the coordinator of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The network is a membership organization comprised of 20 domestic violence and sexual assault programs throughout the state. We are very much in support of House Bill 122. It is one of our highest priorities this legislative session. This bill would delete a loophole in the current Alaska statutes that allows misdemeanors to be handled through a civil compromise in lieu of criminal prosecution in domestic violence cases. When there is a civil compromise, the victim states to the court that she does not want the criminal action against the abuser pursued. If the judge rules that the compensation, usually a promise of no hitting in the future, and a $1 remuneration for pain and suffering offered by the abuser is adequate, the judge then dismisses the criminal case, not allowing the prosecutors to bring criminal charges, and rules favorably, approves the terms of the agreement or the civil compromise. In the past 10 years, there has been a serious effort to change law enforcement and criminal justice response to domestic violence. Based on research that has been completed, there is good reason to believe that when domestic violence is made public the first few times it occurs, that individuals are less likely to continue in an escalating violence pattern. If left unchecked, our experience has been that the violence generally does intensify over time. For this reason, we feel strongly that it is not good public policy to wait for a repetition of harm before intervening. The police procedures around Alaska have been changing to reflect this. More and more departments are now responding to the first call when there is a domestic violence disturbance, arresting when possible, and taking full reports. One of the unfortunate results of domestic violence is that one individual becomes a victim, or at least a person who is intimidated and coerced and frightened, and often physically and or sexually assaulted, into behaving in a manner more acceptable to the partner. It is not surprising that when the abusive partner's attorney approaches the victim with a civil compromise to avoid the court process, that victims agree. Civil compromise assumes that there are two equal parties agreeing to resolving a dispute. These parties are not equal in disputes that involve domestic violence. By having a judge rule that the crime was merely a civil matter between two equal parties, it only reinforces the message that society condones domestic violence. It is also counterproductive to tell law enforcement personnel to respond to these calls and arrest whenever possible, or at least take full reports, if, on the other hand, we legislatively allow a process that circumvents the criminal justice system. A victim of abuse who does not clearly hear from all resources that the abuse is not her fault and is not to be tolerated will generally not leave the abusive relationship until the violence reaches the severity of risking her life or the lives of her children. By that time, the need for counseling for the entire family is so great that government needs to subsidize the majority of the cost through programs like the one I represent, social workers, welfare, medical payments, foster care, special education for children, and jail time for the offender. since we believe it is much sounder public policy to intervene in domestic violence cases and stop the violence at its earliest discernible point, the use of civil compromise is not appropriate. It defeats this purpose. Appropriate intervention is taking place in some communities like Anchorage and Ketchikan through strong arrest policies, which research indicates that in and of themselves do significantly reduce repeat offenses. However, prosecution is also very important so that the offender can be mandated into counseling in lieu of serving jail time. The use of a fairly lengthy suspended imposition of sentence has been the most effective in screening and motivating individuals to utilize existing counseling or community self-help resources. It is not likely that the average battering partner will undergo and complete counseling voluntarily. Nationwide, only about 5% do so. However, counseling has been shown to be very effective for batterers who do complete it. Therefore, offering first-time offenders an alternative sentence of 60 to 90 days of suspended jail time, suspended imposition of sentence, with perhaps a few days of counseling, a credit for serving the day of the arrest, as long as mandatory counseling or the court-approved rehabilitation effort is completed, with the provision that no similar violation is committed for a year, provides the offender with a method for changing his behavior with little negative impact from a criminal record. This appears to be a successful method of intervening in the violence while still offering the couple a chance to repair their lives and relationship with little present or future cost to the family and government. We strongly urge your favorable consideration of this bill.
Ms. Cheney? Yes, Gripton.
Thank you, Chair. Just one question on the carrying of this bill to people who no longer live with the defendant. I mean, I can see the logic. You know, they say a former spouse of the defendant. Once they're no longer living with that person, why is that included with the...
Okay, it's actually a very important provision. One of the reasons is because we see the majority of domestic violence cases occurring at the time of separation. Once the victim actually, if she decides that she is actually going to separate from the partner, then the incidences of domestic violence tend to actually increase, and the severity tends to increase at that time. So it's just because a person is separated or even divorced, it's still important to have protection for the victim.
That's right. I thought a lot of the reason for this, you know, other than the rehabilitation reasons that you're describing, it was that this person had, after settling, would have to go back and face that person who was just taken to court, and so therefore they might be intimidated into not really pursuing the case. But if they don't have to face that person, I don't know.
Yeah, but they can still be intimidated by them really severely. A lot of times there'll be custody issues where there can be a lot of intimidation around who's to take care of the children, you know. They're still, just because a family is going through a divorce or separation doesn't mean that the intimidation and the harassment stop. And we see, I mean, just the opposite, as a matter of fact, that the intimidation and harassment actually increase during that period of time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Yes, Gripson Davis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wonder if you had any questions, any comments on the original version of the legislation versus the judiciary substitute, if you had any comments on either version or which your...
Well, I know that one concern that's been raised by Francis Purdy, who runs the domestic violence office in the municipality of Anchorage, is that she's very concerned that with the deletion of larcenously, that elder abuse, which most often is where relatives will or caretakers will take the social security checks and longevity bonus checks, that sort of thing, wouldn't be covered. But Gail Horetsky is here from the Department of Law, and she's much more able than I to discuss all of the implications of deletion of the word larcenously.
So your organization doesn't have a position on either version?
Well, basically, and because of the impact on the issue of elder abuse, we would support the governor's bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Representative Larson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess not a question, but a comment in relation to this question. It will be my intent to request or the behalf of Representative Swackhammer to make a motion today that the House Finance Committee move House Bill number 122, not the committee substitute for House Bill 122. So that will come up for discussion later on.
Thank you.
Barbara, did you want to testify also? For the record, please.
My name is Barbara Miklas, and I'm an executive director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I briefly wanted to state that it's at the council's instigation that the governor originally introduced this legislation. This was a piece of legislation that we had worked on very hard last year and feel it's very important that it be passed this year. And so I wanted to, Margot Dick went over the reasons that we feel very committed to it, but it is our highest priority, and because we see it as directly related to protection for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And so I wanted you to know that and be available for any questions.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Horesky. I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. This is a governor's bill, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and for the reasons stated by the two previous speakers, we would urge your favorable consideration of the bill. To sort of give you just a very brief orientation, generally, criminal cases, once they're brought, the state of Alaska versus the defendant or the city of Anchorage versus the defendant. And generally speaking, private action doesn't short-circuit that criminal process. The case is taken before a jury or a judge. The judicial system renders a verdict, guilty or innocent, and then the judge takes into consideration all the background of the offense and the offender when fashioning the sentence. Sentences, of course, can and often do include suspended imposition of sentences, suspended sentences, probationary, restitution orders, etc. The judge has a great deal of leniency at the end of the process to decide what's appropriate for this situation, for this offender, for this crime. Civil compromise is an exception to the general way that criminal cases work, and it has a very limited exception. Alaska statute first appeared in our books in 1900 when Alaska laws were first codified back in territorial days. Our present statute appears to be based on a New York statute that was adopted back in 1819, something like that, way before the turn of the century. And many states, including New York, have since repealed their civil compromise statutes, recognizing that there is a public interest in the wrong done to individual people and basically doing away with this very old mechanism that was in place under common law. Alaska retains its civil compromise statute. It's been on the books since statehood, but it has not been amended at all since it was first adopted, and this is the first amendment really to make any changes to it. The reason why this change in the governor's original bill is necessary and why the bill was drafted and presented to you was because there was a case, and it was in actually arose in Fairbanks. The name of the case is State versus Nell, the Court of Appeals case, in which the situation was a woman was severely beaten by her, I think it was boyfriend, and charges were filed, the police were called, he was arrested, charges were filed. She later agreed to a civil compromise, signed a piece of paper, you know, agreed that she was willing to do it. The court dismissed the charges against the defendant over the objection of the DA. Under the civil compromise statutes, the DA's approval or input is not required. And just as a postscript, subsequently, that man came back and beat that woman up again. The recurring cycle of violence that we see commonly in domestic violence situations. The state appealed that civil compromise and said there's a public interest here, you shouldn't allow compromise in domestic violence cases. The Court of Appeals affirmed the judge's decision below allowing the compromise. In other words, the case was dismissed. But the court was troubled by the fact that a defendant could escape criminal liability in situations of this sort. And there was dicta language right in the court opinion itself where the court says, we're very troubled by this, but the law is clear on its face and it doesn't exempt domestic violence cases, so any change is up to the legislature. So following that court invitation for the legislature to change the law, that was the impetus for this bill. Just one final aside to address the question raised by Representative Davis. As you're aware, sir, the original version of the governor's bill was directly focused on the domestic violence problem, and it was a solution to a very specific problem that we've encountered and that we're beginning to see in more and more since the Nels case was decided. There was an amendment adopted in the Judiciary Committee to exempt larcenously, and I would respectfully recommend to the committee that it consider and, if it deems appropriate, favorably pass out the original version of the bill as opposed to the Judiciary Committee substitute. The reason is that larcenously has been in there ever since the statute was originally adopted, and it prevents the civil compromise of all theft-related offenses, not just theft. It would include things such as receiving and concealing stolen property, misdemeanor offenses I'm talking about now, embezzlement, theft by deception, shoplifting, issuing a bad check, fraudulent use of a credit card, forgery of a check, criminal simulation, criminal impersonation, misapplication of property, deceptive business practices, defrauding creditors, receiving unlawful gratuities, i.e. bribes, under $500, and conceivably unsworn falsification. There are in the neighborhood of 15 to 18 separate misdemeanor crimes for which a defendant could buy his way out if, I submit to you, the Judiciary Committee version is adopted. How it would work in reality is the person would be suffer a theft, would have property stolen, money stolen, whatever it may be. He would call the police. The police would come, investigate the case, take fingerprints, measurements, take a photograph of the broken window, whatever it happened to be, write a report, investigate the case. If they're able to develop a suspect, if they're able to get the evidence, then the case would be referred to the DA's office. The DA's office would screen the case, prepare the charges, file the paperwork, do the motions practice, subpoena the witnesses, prepare for trial, and then the day before trial, the defense attorney and or the defendant would be able to go to the victim of the crime and say, here's $150 for the bicycle I stole, let's forget the whole thing and you won't have to go to court tomorrow. The victim perhaps has no knowledge of whatever history this defendant might have, how many times he or she has done it before, may very well accept that and say, well, it sounds like a good deal to me, and the DA has absolutely no input, no control over this. They may know that the defendant has been doing this for a long time, but they're not even there when this deal is struck. And there's absolutely nothing in the language of the present bill that would prevent that kind of a process from occurring again and again and again. I submit to you that, especially in an era of scarce resources, the troopers, the police, the prosecutors have more to do with their time than to be very expensive and cumbersome private bill collectors, in effect, or private dispute resolution mechanisms. If a defendant is convicted of theft, it's up to the court to decide what's the appropriate sentence. The person could still get a suspended sentence. The courts routinely order restitution, so we're certainly not foreclosing the victim getting his money back or getting his property back. But at that point, the court has a handle over the defendant to say, no new criminal violations for a year, or you'll go to jail, or you have to go to alcohol counseling, whatever it is that the court might feel is appropriate. I am very concerned that the adoption of the version that takes out larcenously would, in effect, allow a defendant to buy his way out of criminal charges and remove any deterrence in the present law for related theft-related offenses. Because the worst that's going to happen to him if he's caught is he has to give the property back. It doesn't sound like much of a deterrent.
Have you looked at the fifth or with the word larcenous in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, we ran a records check to try to determine how many larcenously related misdemeanor cases we prosecute a year.
And as best we could tell, we were talking in the neighborhood of 2,000 cases a year, misdemeanor cases, which theoretically would not be prosecuted under the new scheme. Now, I'm not saying we would refuse to take them, but what I think would happen was that we would take them, and ultimately at the end they would all be dismissed, so you would have a whole pool of dismissed cases, nothing to show for your effort, and you've expended a considerable amount of resources going forward with 2,000 cases that had no successful resolution.
Representative Frank.
Gail, can you give us, I'm trying to get a feel for what crimes that would still be compromisable are today.
Well, there are very, very few cases, really, that are compromisable. A misdemeanor trespass, for example, might be. Disorderly conduct, perhaps, where somebody used offensive words to you and, you know, provoked fisticuffs, and people might be able to agree to settle that out. It's really very, very narrow, Representative Frank, because this doesn't appear on the face of the statute, Mr. Chairman, but there are several classes of cases where the appellate court has said, you see the lead-in language there says, if a defendant has is held to answer for a misdemeanor for which the person injured by the act has a remedy at civil action. In other words, so the qualifying language at the front is you have to have a remedy at civil action. And in a whole class of cases, such as DWI cases, such as leaving the scene of the accident cases, reckless driving, that sort of thing, the court has said we will not allow compromise because a drunk driver injures the public good. It's not a private dispute. So even though DWI isn't listed there, DWI is not compromisable. There are very few cases under existing law, really, which are compromisable.
Thank you. Thank
you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you're saying then is that it's just a common law precedent only. That there's no statute that enumerates what's civilly compromisable. You enumerate what are exceptions to that which can't. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chairman, the civil compromise mechanism developed that common law and was codified way back in the 1800s in the state statutes of every many states, including New York, from which ours is taken. What this statute says, what Alaska statute says, is if a defendant is held to answer and on that charge the person injured has a remedy at civil action, then it can be compromised except, and then they list the exceptions. So it's ultimately up to a court to decide, is this the kind of a case for which the victim has a remedy at civil action? And the court said in the case of leaving the scene of an accident, the victim doesn't have a remedy at civil action because the victim is society. The victim is not merely the guy who got hit by the drunk driver. It's every person who could have gotten killed by that reckless behavior.
Somewhere you could look up what generally is a crime which has a remedy at civil action. Somewhere else in the statutes you can go and look those up.
Mr. Chairman, no, not really. There is a body of law that would tell you that, but you'd have to go to the cases. There's no statute.
I have one other question, Mr. Chairman. On civil actions, and this gets back a little bit to the bill we just had, but if you are found guilty in a criminal action, that doesn't preclude someone who's injured from coming after you for civil damage as well.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely not.
On top of anything that the judge orders, you can still sue if you're an injured party.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Further
questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Margaret Burke.
Thank you. My name is Margaret Burke. I'm with the Public Defender's Office. I'm the supervising attorney in Juneau, Alaska, and I've been asked to testify with respect to House Bill 122 and the provision taking out larcenously. In answer to one of your questions, in the last 6 months, as an attorney operating in the trenches of our court system, I have done one civil compromise. It was where an 18 or 19-year-old boy in Petersburg wrote his initials and his girlfriend's initials in wet concrete, and he was charged with criminal mischief. And we worked it out with the city of Petersburg that he would pay for the cost of the repair of the concrete. We noticed up the civil compromise. We made it by way of a motion, which allows the state to to respond as to whether or not it was an appropriate mechanism to use to resolve that case, and we waited until the court made its decision as to whether or not it was appropriate, and the court granted it. It was not something that was done on the eve of trial, and in fact, I would suggest perhaps is very fiscally responsible way of resolving those kinds of cases. Under the bill that was passed out apparently by the House Judiciary Committee, it would allow attorneys to further compromise other matters, mostly misdemeanor theft offenses. It's been certainly my experience that there are many extremely petty theft offenses that go through the court system. There have been cases where somebody goes to a restaurant, buys a dinner, passes out, doesn't pay his $4.95 for his cheeseburger. There have been other cases where a person will take a taxi cab, ride somewhere, and not pay the cab company, or will pass a bad check to that cab company for that ride. I have had complaints from city prosecutors where they felt like they were doing the collection work for these businesses. And it can be very effective collection work because the person always has the hammer of that criminal conviction hanging over their head. I would suggest that perhaps many of these cases don't even come to the court system and are resolved by parties far short of the law enforcement agencies or the criminal justice system even getting involved. It's been my experience in the handful of civil compromises that I have done that the victims are very happy. They get much quicker results than waiting your 60-day or 90-day turnaround in misdemeanor courts before that person may be convicted or enter a change of plea and is required to make some sort of restitution over the next year while they're on probation and have suspended time hanging over their heads. Oftentimes, victims, for example, in shoplifting cases, may have their merchandise held as evidence in a particular case while the criminal justice system grinds along. I think that that there are some real fiscal advantages to keeping in the provisions which would allow individuals to civilly compromise those kinds of offenses. Misdemeanor thefts, for the most part, are very petty. And as I recalled, I think that there's a $500 benchmark when it becomes a felony. Therefore, as long as your permanent fund dividends keep coming along at $500 or more, you would never be able to compromise those kinds of offenses, which was something raised by one of the other speakers here. I don't know what Social Security benefits are, but if they're beyond that amount, they would not be subject to compromise. This is only for very petty misdemeanor offenses, which would be $500, $500 or less. I would also point out, as far as what really happens in the court system when a person is charged with a petty offense, it's their first-time offense, or maybe they don't have a very egregious past criminal record, traditionally they would be offered pretrial diversion. State wouldn't be getting convictions on those things. The state wouldn't be waiting to the eve of trial and doing all this trial preparation. Very early on, the state makes an offer of pretrial diversion. They never get a conviction on that person. If the person ends up paying back the money, which is one of the primary concerns of pretrial diversion, that matter is dismissed. There is no longer a pretrial diversion program. Some of the end result, I think, if you kept the bill the way it is you'd be able to see some of those similar kinds of mechanisms continue, but without the monitoring, perhaps, of the personnel that were involved in pretrial diversion. Often, I think, too, what happens if a person is a first-time offender or doesn't have much of a prior criminal record, they'll get a suspended imposition of sentence, which means that once they pay back that money, that conviction comes off their record. So after a period of time, whether you're talking pretrial diversion or suspended imposition of sentence, you're talking about somebody at some point down the road who no longer has that conviction on their record. I think that the bill as it stands now has some fiscal responsible incentives built into it and would allow attorneys and prosecutors in this state and individuals in this state to continue along the lines that Alaska has had for many years, which essentially allows individuals to create and make their own remedies. Oftentimes, in order to obtain the civil compromise, the person who has been victimized might not only achieve his return of his property, but have that person do some extra work around the restaurant or around the store. And oftentimes, victims have been very pleased to be a part of that system. And it would allow Alaskans to continue to resolve their problems on their own without marshaling into full-blown court proceedings. And I would ask you to consider all of those factors in your decision on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess at what point, we talked about 3,000, you know,
at what point does this be, would become a compromise? I mean, is it a time before charges are brought? I mean, what, you know,
what's the time period
for settlement before it would become
full-blown court proceedings? And I would ask you to consider all of those factors in your decision on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess at what point, we talked about 3,000,
you know, at what point does this be, would become a compromise? I mean, is it a time before charges are brought? I mean, what, you know,
what's the time period
for settlement before it would become a compromise, I guess, is my question.
Under the statutes, it's required that the person is charged. So he would be charged and have a criminal complaint filed against him. He would either be summoned into court or perhaps arrested and then later bailed out. But once he is charged, then this statute comes into operation and he can civilly compromise it. With pretrial diversion, the person is also charged and in and out of the court system at some level, but usually early on is when pretrial diversion is offered to a defendant or the defendant may raise a civil compromise.
Okay, so, yeah, I can see how the pretrial diversion would be ruled out. I guess the other thing I was wondering is on number three, it says with an intent to commit a felony, and you referred to a dollar limit. Are you saying that if the larcenously gets big enough, it qualifies under felony?
That's right. And you'll see the act is entitled Authority to Compromise Certain Misdemeanors. So you're talking about misdemeanor theft or larcenous type offenses, not felonies.
It's $500 is the cutoff?
I think the $500 is the cutoff. There are, I think, two breakouts for misdemeanor thefts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, the public defenders.
Yes.
With or without the word larcenous? Which one do you guys support now?
We would support taking out the language larcenously.
Representative Gull.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to just make sure I have your testimony clearly. Pretrial diversion is used in misdemeanor.
Pretrial diversion has been, I've been offered pretrial diversion in a shoplifting case here in this community.
It's being used time in this state?
No. Not.
Pretrial diversion is being eliminated. By that, do you mean it's not funded in the budget in this current proposal by the governor?
As I understand it, there's pretrial diversion no longer exists, or it is seriously underfunded and understaffed at this point in time.
As I understand it, pretrial diversion is not used for misdemeanors. By your testimony, as I understand it, pretrial diversion does exist. It just hasn't shown up in the governor's budget proposal.
Okay.
I just want to make sure I was clear there. And you also made reference to doing things the way we do. Am I not correct that the way we do that is under the statute of marijuana in the statute?
I'm sorry, I don't know what you mean by that.
Okay. I don't think I need to pursue the question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Any further questions? Representative Larson.
Let's see if I can break it down into simple terms. If we would go with the committee substitute for House Bill number 1, from my understatement, for example, someone went down to the local store and stole something that was valued $100. your testimony is saying then if that person was caught,
mm-hmm.
it could be or would be better for those concerned. That person then had to go to the storekeeper and pay the $100 or $110, what it would to take that person to court.
That's correct.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a couple of questions. The first one would be, I guess the definition of a victim is a person that store owner that loses a candy bar by shoplifter, he's considered a victim. Is that correct?
Right. And under the normal criminal system, the culprit would be required to provide restitution to that person for the 75-cent candy bar.
Okay. And I guess the question I had, and this really refers to earlier testimony, but it has to do with concern that people had about perhaps a woman being a victim of a crime and that providing restitution for the loss of, let's say, it would have to be under $500, I guess, but and then a problem, a reoccurring problem of violence to that person because of the out-of-court settlement. So I guess my question would be, on line 18, it says, with commit a felony, so I would think that if a woman or a person is a victim of beating or whatever happens to be the case, they would probably be there would probably be a felony being committed there, I would think. I'm not real familiar with all the...
That's correct. If there was a theft or of some sort that was $500 or more, it would become a felony. As far as the domestic violence provisions, I have no problems with those.
I guess what I was saying is that I guess there was some testimony regarding the, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, larcenously or
uh-huh.
provision, whether that stay in or stay out. That would be... I guess if that was in conjunction with other domestic violence, there probably would be a felony being committed there. That's what I'm trying to ask.
I suppose if it were a domestic violence situation, you could not compromise it under subsection 4. Just like if an incident, if there is a theft incident that occurs riotously, I go into a liquor store and break bottles or I break the store window to get in to steal the bottles, okay, you could possibly make an argument that that's riotously and therefore is not subject to civil compromise. I've had cases where attempts at civil compromise where a car window is broken or a store window is broken, where the state has successfully argued that it was riotously and therefore not subject to the civil compromise. But I would reach each of those four subsections as separate, different categories of types of cases that you cannot civilly compromise.
So if I could clarify from my own purpose, then the domestic violence considerations would be covered whether or not we include larcenously.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Max Groenberg, and representative from District 11. The amendment with respect to larcenously was originally put in at my request, and that's the reason I'm here. The bill that you have before you was the subject of considerable debate in the House Judiciary Committee. The act itself, the civil compromise statute, is a very difficult act because there are a lot of competing different policies involved. And the real question, I think, when you get right down to it, is whether we are going to basically eliminate the civil compromise statute or cut it back to the point where, as Ms. Horesky said, there are very few situations in which the act will be allowable. In other words, very few situations in which you can civilly compromise a criminal case. A civil compromise, basically, is a situation in which one person has committed a wrong against another, and the victim has a civil cause of action, and the parties agree, basically, that the charge will be dropped. They go before the court, and the court, under this statute, has the authority to drop the charges. It's not required to drop the charge. The judge has the discretion whether to drop the charge. Now, you can say, well, look, if there's a case like this, why doesn't the district attorney just drop the charge? And it's my thought, and I think that Ms. Horesky can correct me.